Good morning, everybody.
Hello.
It's another Monday, so that means another theme for the week.
Yes. Just another Magic Monday.
Yes. Magic Monday? Manic Monday. You just changed the lyrics of that song.
Yeah. Because wow.
You're an innovator. Yeah. And innovation is about change.
There we go. Nice segue.
We are talking about change this week.
And it's episode 190.
Yeah,
nice,
getting
this round number.
It's not as good as 200, which is just around the corner for us.
Coming up.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to be talking about change. I think we're going to tend to lean towards the political idea of change. How do we nurture change? What does that look like? But I'm sure we'll get deep into the spiritual goo as well.
Yeah.
It's a fun topic.
It is. It's a big topic.
Yeah.
Say hi to Kathleen and Gus.
Morning.
And whoever else is out there. Yeah, and I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
And I'm Mark Van Steenwijk. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination. Ceres says good morning.
Hey, sir. Hey, Ceres. And, you know, as is occasionally, maybe even often the case, our topic certainly aligns with a very relevant thing. So for those of you that are far and wide and not up on the news, police department in the Twin Cities shot an unarmed black man last night.
Not to be confused with the myriad other times that happens. This is the latest in a long chain.
Right. Yeah. Yep. And so, you know, that's not changing, right? That's still happening. And, you know, you would think, right, that in the Twin Cities, in the midst of certainly one of the most important trials of the century, you know, police would be a little more cautious about doing something like this, right? So unlike the guy that the police killed a few blocks from my house a month or so ago, you know, this truly was, you know, unarmed. This was a traffic stop for having air fresheners hanging from your rear view mirror, which is one of the many things that black people get stopped for in America.
Right.
Like
I've heard that. I know that police officers will use whatever reason they want, but yeah, what is it about air fresheners in particular that's?
Well, it could be anything. It's illegal to have things hang from your rearview mirror because it obstructs your view.
Astonishingly, I've had stuff hang from my mirror and I was never stopped.
Me neither. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's one of the excuses that police use to stop black people. And, you know, this guy did not have a weapon. This guy was not a threat. If you see pictures of him, he looks like he's probably about 100 pounds with his clothes wet, you know, and now he's dead. So, one of the things, you know, about change that we know is that on the one hand, things are always changing, mm-hmm. right? And we human beings appear to be stuck in what physicists talk about as the arrow of time. So that means that we experience this thing called time moving from past through the present into the future. Seems to just be going one way. So, you know, we talk about history, we make plans for the future, all that sort of thing. And one of the interesting things about the arrow of time is that it's not really very well understood why that's happening. Because if you look at other the other kinds of topics that determine the way that material reality appears to be made up, there's no reason that the arrow of time should exist. In other words, things should be able to go backwards just as easily as they go forwards. But we don't have that experience. So change is then built in. Mm-hmm. It's going on all the time. And yet we also have the experience, particularly in social and cultural things, but also in our personal lives. You know, somebody that, you know, I've been in therapy a lot. I work with people in therapy. I know a lot of people that do therapy, that work with people in therapy, right? And one of the experiences that we have is that, you know, some things don't seem to change much, or it's very hard to get things to change. So on the one hand, things are always changing. And on the other hand, things seem to never be changing. And so this is the kind of the great conundrum, you know, that we're always trying to sort of solve. And then we also have a third experience, which is that sometimes things change really fast. And then we're always like, how did that happen? How can I make that happen again with some other issue?
You know, it's interesting, like in this conversation, we've talked about kind of a really gritty political, sociopolitical reality of police violence. And then we're talking about kind of cosmic level stuff. And oftentimes that kind of jumping between those two frustrates people. I've noticed that, like, if you talk about this big abstraction stuff, people get irritated because somehow it seems impractical. But to me, this is really these two things, like, how do we understand what change even is, and is it possible, and what is will and intention and action, really have huge implications for how we approach things. And it's why it's important to kind of jump back and forth and think about these from different angles, because one of the big operative myths, and I get into disputes about this at least once a week at this point in my life, where I'll run into someone who really honestly believes that what we think of as society, with all of its embedded myths and structures, is simply the sum totality of individual actions and choices. And that basically the only way you can confront things is as an individual is just to kind of, like, you know, just in a very simple way, just do different things. Now, at some level, that's true. Like, obviously, all we have is ourselves and the things we can do in the world. So there's some truth to that. But this idea that somehow we're all individually culpable for society being what it is because we can make true choices that are unencumbered by acts of intention and will is a very naive and problematic way of seeing the world, because it puts so much power and the ability of choice as though it were a free action, which is then, okay, so all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, Mark, you lost me because we're talking about abstractions. Well, it really becomes practical, like when you start thinking, like, what can I do myself and with other people to change something that's bad? And so you get a lot of people thinking it's about their will and intention. So it's why protesting can feel so cathartic and feel powerful, even though by itself, protesting, showing up in the streets by itself usually doesn't do a whole lot.
Except when it does.
You don't really have a lot of say of when it does or doesn't. You don't. All right, like, yeah.
Right. So we're getting some comments already, which is great.
CK writes, this is about as Chang, or I don't know if that's a typo. I want to believe that there's someone named Chang involved in this trend here, but there's a link from CK. I'll leave it up for, you know, a little bit longer so people can follow it. I have no idea what that's about. So if you want to flesh that out for us, because I don't have the ability to, like, click that link right now.
Something about trends.
Yeah. Series writes, we are scared of change. Yeah, because you don't know what's going to happen when things change. We hold on to habits and ideas that soothe our survival mechanism until our desires and longings are stronger than holding on to our own. I mean, that shit, either that or it's
the starkery.
Yeah,
it could be.
It's a dollar sign percentage up. I don't know how to pronounce that last symbol. Kathleen writes, it seems to me that change is hard because we know what happened in the past, but we can only imagine the future. It seems safer to anchor to the past. I mean, this is an important point. It's why people will often settle for horrible things. I mean, one of the big fears that I feel like a lot of liberals, moderates, progressive people who I would consider the folks who share my sentiments about things, who have leftist sentiments, but are don't like revolutionary change, like that, those groups of people, because they're worried that it'll make things worse. And so the idea is often, this is bad. Let's just try to make it a little bit better by not changing the game board a whole lot, because the change that you're suggesting, a revolutionary change, could make things worse. So let's stick with this. That's kind of the fear of change, and why people will often, even who are experiencing oppression, will be like, this oppression is better than something worse.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's great. Mark, between the comments you made and Sirius, what you just said, Kathleen, what you just said, I think those three comments bring up some of the classic overarching issues around change and perceptions. And I would also suggest misperceptions, right? Mm-hmm. So, and this is what's so fascinating to me. I mean, I've been thinking about this, studying this, reading about this for decades now, because I just think it's so incredibly interesting. What I find is that for every time we sort of say something about change, there's also an opposite, right? And, you know, and many spiritual traditions talk about paradox, talk, you know, yin and yang, the I Ching, all of these, you know, different things point this out, right? So, like, for example, we're scared of change. So on the one hand, that's absolutely true, except for the changes that we're used to and we're not scared of. So we are often scared of change, mm-hmm. when it has to do with things that are very important and dear to us and that we're really holding on to and that form part of our identity. Right. So, for example, sunrise and sunset, those are changes. We're not really scared of those changes because we're used to them and they're fine. And we kind of like them. We take pictures of sunrise and sunsets. Doesn't really bother us, right? But, you know, if we talk about getting rid of the police.
Oh, my God.
Right. That's a change that terrifies people. Right? And in part, it's because it's not happened, right? So changes that we don't understand and have never happened before are really scary to us. And it's also a change that feels threatening to us, right? So that's the other part of it, because we think, oh, you know, something bad might happen to me. Right. So there's all these really interesting, complex, interwoven issues when it comes to change.
I mean, this raises so many interesting political and philosophical questions. So, like with the police thing alone, because we're seeing a lot of that. Minneapolis is like getting a lot of attention in ways that like we never would have predicted. Like, it's not like George Floyd was the first person murdered by the police, but something about these unpredictable elements coming together to charge a moment and a place. And so then all of a sudden there's these ripple effects where people have this ability, all of a sudden they're shocked out of their myths. So like I like talking about myths all the time. Myths are kind of maps of reality. And so like we tend to confuse reality with the myths that are most conditioned into us. And one of the myths is that chaos is evil, order is good, and the way to maintain order is through power and authority, and that we have these systems in place, and then we have democracy to keep them in check. All these myths that are not even necessarily that true, right? So when you start saying no police, all of a sudden it's like, how can you have society without police? Everything will fall apart. We'll have people in the street eating babies. Like that kind of, oh my God. So why is it
that? I thought that's what happens if you don't have religion.
That's police. Religion is a type of control. That's why Marx It really, it is. So
just think, there's all this pent up desire to eat babies.
Yeah.
Like, think about it. I mean, there's
every time I walk by a baby, I think sandwich, hot dish. And I'm like, but no, God will get mad and the police might hurt me. So I'm not going to eat those babies.
The baby. It's like massive baby eating festival would occur.
I mean, that's the Minnesota State Fair, but with babies.
Oh, that would be the new food. That'd be the new food in the religionless, policeless Minnesota. That would be the new food.
Batter
baby
fried
on a stick.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love joking about babies, but I also know, because I'm married to someone who doesn't like jokes about eating babies, that there are probably people who are disturbed by this, but I find it hilarious. Anyways, yeah. This question of like, well, why is it that some people are like, damn it, I think we don't need the police. Let's imagine something different. And other people are like, no, I can't even imagine that. That idea of like some people having the capacity or the will or whatever to start thinking about alternatives, that's not up to them, right? That's not like an act of intention and will to get to that point. Somehow their perception shifts. And even understanding why some people's perception shifts on this stuff is almost impossible to guess. And so when we start talking about will and intention shaping society, it's like, oh, it starts breaking down. Comments because we spend too much time talking about baby eating. Sarah, we are a cultural body.
Right. So that brings up a whole other piece to this. And I kind of view this episode one, this is why I like this week-long thing. This is sort of setting up the problem, right? And then we can get into it. Right. So, Sirius, you bring up this other great point, right? That there are all these different levels to reality that that actually are part of the movement of the universe.
Yeah.
And have effect, right? Because when we're talking about change, we're talking about some sort of force or energy. We're talking about movement. We're talking about ability to shape things, right? Octavia Butler talks about shaping change in her great Seed Cycle books, which are way more terrifying than the idea of eating babies, by the way. So, and so depending on what level of reality you are willing to admit to or pay attention to, that is also going to affect how you're going to understand and see change, right? So, you know, Mark, when you're talking about if I'm just the only person in the game and it's like my will or maybe me and my 10 friends, we're going to change the world, and we're not paying attention to the fact that, no, wait a minute, there are cultural bodies, there are principalities and powers, there's spiritual energy. Right, we tend to overestimate our own power in many ways, right? And so right. So what levels of engagement are we willing to pay attention to when we're talking about change?
Well, and we don't like the impotent feeling of not being able to affect too much change. And so it's funny to me when people think that somehow, like, want to lean heavily into this idea that one person can change the world. Which there's sometimes that's true.
Hollywood theme.
Sometimes that kind of is true, but most of the time not. It's like, I'm not like, so I've been talking about this all the time. Like right now I'm in the middle of a season of particularly frustrating depression. I can't even change myself right now. So what makes me think that I can somehow change society? So I don't want to be naive. Like you have to try, because there's alchemy involved that we don't quite understand. So there's nothing to be benefited from me just laying down and dying, right? Nihilism is not really an option for me, right? But this idea that somehow, like this chaos feeling, this feeling of impotency, is why we put so much weight on things that are largely symbolic that don't affect a whole lot of change. Okay, it's why we get upset at someone driving an SUV instead of a Prius, as though that one choice is consequential. Does it matter? Does it tie into other choices? Is there symbolic weight to it? Yes. But we sometimes treat the SUV driver like they're the embodiment of the devil, because we put so much weight on a symbolic choice that doesn't have by itself a whole lot of weight. Or voting. Like, is voting important? Yes, if you scale it up, but it's not as powerful as we'd like it to be. But if someone votes for them, like Jill Stein instead of Barack Obama, then they're the devil. Like, we put a lot of weight. Why is that? Partly because we recognize deep down inside we don't have as much power as we'd like, and we overemphasize the powerfulness of the choices we feel like we do have, whether they're impactful or not, which is right. Fun to talk about. So getting to the next comment, Gus says, a couple weeks back, one of my favorite authors read an essay on his podcast about how AI and machine learning, that for one example, used by police to figure out where to look for drugs. It's a short essay worth a listen or read. And there's the link from, I love that website, craphound.com.
Yeah.
I like that. So I'll leave that up for just a second. Next comment. Tyler writes, is part of the reason why things remain stagnant and unable to change is because of many resisting to accept that they're wrong? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a part of it for sure.
Yeah. So again, if change, so there's, you know, again, there's a bottom line of change that's always happening, right? So there's a flow that is always going on. And that flow is highly conditioned, right? We've talked about karma on the show before. That flow is highly conditioned. It is highly spontaneous. It has a motion of its own. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes when we are talking, particularly in the social and political arena, but also in terms of health, when we're talking about change, what we're talking about is shifting that flow, mm-hmm. right? So that's one way to sort of zero in on this. The flow of change happens no matter what, right? So, and again, you know, Tyler, what you're talking about, I mean, people are just kind of zombies and we're just going along and society is kind of a zombie society. And it's just going along. And so oftentimes when we're talking about change, what we're really talking about is, can we become aware of this flow and shift it? Right. And as you know, a couple of you have hinted at, that takes some effort, right? It takes, something has to happen. And so then really the question becomes, more than anything else, what is that something? Can we really understand what that something might be? Or do we oftentimes expend a lot of energy trying to make that something happen that is irrelevant or useless?
CK writes, I think when we talk about change, we need to know who is in charge of making change happen and on what level. This is another piece to this, why political conversations fall apart. Power is a huge piece of, like, if you have power in our society, it means that you're invested in the system as it is and are unlikely to want it to change. And you also have, in some ways, not in every way, a greater ability to affect change. Right, so that's part of the reason why lefty people tend to want to hold more powerful people more accountable and less powerful people less accountable and hone in. But if you see society as the sum total of human choices at kind of like a flat level, which a lot of people do, when you start talking about power, it becomes inane to folks because people really honestly believe that I have as much power to affect change as Jeff Bezos and across the board. Which is stupid. Now, I do have the same power to affect change in some ways, but not when it comes to economic and political power to affect change. Of course, there's always these things, except for one I don't. Like, so one of the great examples, and this whole time I'm thinking about Jesus dying on the cross, because the part of the whole basis of Christianity is somehow this Palestinian peasant in this three-year cycle, culminating with his death and resurrection, that history hinged on that moment of the crucifixion in some weird way that we can't quite comprehend, and that 2,000 years we've been trying to figure out what changed. The idea that a peasant can change the fabric of reality is a provocative idea and part of the whole point. Because normally it's the Herods and the Pilates who can affect change, but a peasant going to the cross, how does that change things? Is part of the potency of Christianity.
Comments? All right. Let's keep rolling.
Ceres writes, the myth of the sum individual choices solves stuff is crap. It ignores the reality of cause and effect in ecosystem, for sure.
Yep.
Gus writes, machine learning takes shitty decisions in the past, are laundered through a system to appear value neutral, making them harder to oppose.
Yep.
I mean, we could have, that's unpacking that statement could take a long time, but yes, it's one of the issues involved with AI that we don't really usually talk about.
Yeah. And, you know, as we develop AI, what we're seeing is it's exactly the same in a lot of ways as our own mental processes, is that the results depend on the inputs. And machines are going to be just as limited in their thinking as human beings are.
Like, I mean, one of the ways this takes shape and the way it has political implications is facial recognition, or even putting your hand underneath a faucet tends to recognize white skin better than darker skin. And then people say, well, that's just the nature of how light works. I'm like, no, it has to do with, if you have white scientists or light skin scientists programming stuff, the input, it's going to have the output of recognizing lighter skin more. And that actually has political implications.
Right.
You know, CK writes, the link from earlier is from Homeland Security and what changes will happen in the next 20 years with what we know and following the logical course. I don't know if I want to click that link. I can tell it's not going to be fun to read.
Yeah, well, except that brings up a very fascinating observation, right? Is that if you look at, one of the biggest industries out there in media, in something like Homeland Security, in, you know, corporate America, is predicting the future, trying to predict trends, right? And if you look at that stuff, it is amazing how usually people are wrong. No, usually people are wrong. Mm-hmm. And so that should give us pause to think about the fact that clearly our ability to understand change, mm-hmm. which has got to have something to do with our ability to understand not only how change happens, but what are the inputs and outputs and how does this whole thing work, is incredibly limited. But predicting it not only, you know, makes a lot of people money, but it makes us feel better. You think, oh, I know what's going to happen. Right now, if the last year has not taught us that we don't have a clue what's going to happen in the future, I don't know what is going to teach us that.
Ellen writes, this oppression is better than something worse. I want to go back to Egypt where I can get a hamburger with onions. It's a great reference to the Exodus. They wanted to go back in this bondage because it seemed they could at least eat onions instead of eating their shitty manna every day. Ellen writes, Egypt in Hebrew is a constricted place, and the Bible talks about going to wide open places, which always makes me think about people who suffer from agoraphobia. Ellen goes on, if we are minuscule organisms in a giant universe body, I wonder if the body was relatively resting for a time, and maybe is now looking to run a marathon or something.
Deep thoughts by Ellen Moore. Yeah, nice.
Karen writes, good morning to you both. Good morning, Karen. Okay, so in my chat with a friend yesterday, she asked this question. What are we outside of what we've been constructed to be?
What are we outside of what we've been constructed to be?
That's a big question.
Well, I mean, in some ways, we aren't anything. And that's kind of one of the central points to all of this is that we are formed right by this flow, and so that's what constructs us. And certainly without any kind of reflection or other sort of input outside of that, we are nothing, right? And this is, you know, the kind of contemplative emptiness that is talked about. And so what awareness, what spiritual practice, what interaction is with other people who are in a different part of the flow, right, who have a different experience, and really being able to listen to that and set aside our own reality, that's what starts to reconstruct us, right? But the problem is there's that deconstruction period. And this, Howard Thurman has a great comment about that. He said, when knowledge comes, the whole world changes. Suddenly, we're now not what we used to be constructed to be, but we're not anything new yet. And that's that very uncomfortable period, right? And using Ellen's example, right? That's that wilderness period. And we don't like that.
No. And, you know, usually these sort of truth bombs, when we're confronted with them, we want to go back because it's safe. And so you have to kind of go through it. And to me, this is really why it's, I rail against this all the time, models of spirituality that are about soothing and coping. It's because really change happens because we're willing to persevere through discomfort. And so it's decentering. It's upsetting. And then going through that, that, to me, that's the only path for discernment. Like, you know, we talk about discernment a lot, and in some ways it's a silly idea that somehow there's this spirit of God doing stuff around there. And that if we can have different practices and postures and relationships in solidarity with people, that we can perceive what is other, what things that are outside of the prediction of the flow. And you can then therefore make meaningful choices based on discernment. It's a ridiculous idea if you just have a purely mechanistic view of things. And I get it. Like, it's a silly idea, but to me, it's all I got. That's why I tell people all the time, I've said this a lot of times, I'm 99% deterministic, but my faith lives in the 1% where there's a possibility of change.
Wait, so you're for the 1%ers?
In this circumstance, I am. The spiritual 1%.
The spiritual 1%.
The rich in spirit who are... Anyways. Yeah. And so, yeah. I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous idea. But there's power. I mean, otherwise, we're just kind of... We are just what we're programmed to be. Alan writes, a friend was just telling me in recovery places, spaces like AA, every person begins at some level of assuming, quote, I'm not like these people who are really addicts and need this, end quote. Convincing people that they need to be there is a step that comes before the 12 steps.
Right. Yeah. And this is, and, you know, I mentioned this, I think last week, you know, this is one of my favorite little spiritual phrases, right? Revulsion is the foot of meditation. Mm-hmm. Right? And so revulsion is part of the energy that moves us into change. It's one of those things that shifts the flow a little bit.
Catherine writes, when I feel slow and useless, I have been contemplating the fact that change needs to happen slow and fast at the same time. Some urgently needed change, like reforestation or wetlands being created, only can happen really slowly. And that's part of the, that's why patience is a virtue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, you know, we are, because we don't live very long, right? We have a very limited time view. We want to focus on the changes that can happen quickly. But yes, if we look at the majority of changes, let's say that have happened in the universe, they all happen very, very slowly relative to my lifetime, right? And so we're like, oh, yeah, you know, the dinosaurs, you know, were around and then went extinct. And, you know, and we think, oh, they went extinct in a day. It's like, no, it took about, you know, 30 million years. Well, we don't have patience to wait around for 30 million years for things. But yes, I mean, the very significant change also happens very, very slowly, which means that in our lifetime, we may see none of it, right? It's so the increment in our lifetime is so tiny that we may see none of it, which, again, is why from the spiritual life perspective, that kind of humility around our own powerlessness is so important to be also present and life-giving and loving and caring for the quick things that we can change. Right.
We're low on time, so I'm going to try to blaze through some of these real fast.
Blaze away.
Good comments today. Sarah's right. It's not surprising the industry is being wrong on predicting the future. I mean, they have their vested interest in how they predict things. That's kind of like how it works. Catherine writes, I have also been reminding myself that the whole idea of a person being quote unquote useless is often rooted in capitalist ableism and eugenics. And that mind shift in turn can transform the available possibilities, how I can imagine change. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're conditioned to,
right. Changing the frame. Right. The notion that a person is useless is horrible.
There's so much embedded in that, and it's toxic.
Yeah.
And we could go off on that for a long time, I'm sure. Mana burgers, banana bread. That's my recipe for banana bread. This is why I pulled up this comment, is I make banana bread I call banana mana, so people know. Sarah's writes, prediction ends up being wrong by people who are not trained to considering answers and patterns and possibilities that I don't want to see but need to see. That's right. We have a very selective way of examining and perceiving the world based upon our assumptions and previous experiences, which is why, by the way, any talk about spirituality that doesn't have some sort of component on solidarity with people who are experiencing the short end of the stick is kind of meaningless to me, because even a spiritual life, it's not magic. Solidarity is still required to be able to understand the nature of our systems.
Well, and it's also why, you know, prophets tend to end up being both right and not listened to.
Ellen writes, as far as not being big uncomfortable, do you all know that kids camp song, "We Are Going on a Bear Hunt"? I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
Every time you get to an obstacle, you can go around it. You can go over it. You've got to go through it. I've never heard this.
Yeah. I know that one, Ellen. Add that to the Jesus Anarchist playlist.
Is that a Christian song?
You guys are working on it. No, it's just kind of a camp song.
That's why, unless it references Jesus explicitly, I wouldn't know it from a camp. Lavinia writes, "We are change." Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a confession of faith right there.
It's also true.
I think it's true.
Yeah.
Lisa writes, "There's a link there.
3 mile hour post you."
So 3 mile an hour God. Yeah, so there's probably a book called Three Mile Hour God by Kosuke Koyama. Check that out. There's some pumpkin spice comments I'm going to jump over because it's not autumn. Ellen writes, in this time we know of, 40 billion years, if we scale down to 40 years, humans have been here 4 hours, and the Industrial Revolution has been here 1 minute, and half the trees are already gone. Humans bring change. More comments about pumpkin spice and the bear hunt.
And there's a bear song.
So we're gonna leave it there. Let's leave it with Lavinia's comment, "We are change." Yep. What does that mean?
All right.
I think that's where we're gonna go maybe a little bit more next time.
Yeah, on Wednesday.
We'll see y'all on Wednesday. And
thank you very much.
The great comments.
Yeah.
See you soon.
Wonderful to be with you all on this tough day. All right. Bye.